So welcome,
pardon me,
welcome to our evening program of question and response. As I said before, we're not promising any definitive answers, but you may get a colourful array of suggestions. So the invitation is for you to ask a question, and if the question could be a fairly short and succinct, rather than 5 minutes long, that would be very helpful. And it may be that you have to speak very loudly from the floor or even come to the front. You're welcome to address a question to just one person or to all three. Yes. I definitely have to give that question to somebody else.
Oh my God. Jonathan.
Why you don't meditate?
Why do you? He's good at that.
You have it. Daily life.
Yeah, repeat the question.
Okay.
Maybe Jonathan can use this one.
It doesn't neither reach it.
I don't know why I got to answer this. You don't have daily life to view? Yeah, just 24 hours in holy life, so I don't know what daily life is. I have a nice story for this. Something that you should have said. I don't remember the question. First the story and then we hear the question. Let me see if I get it right. Yeah, it's about a teacher, a lecturer, who is a scientist and is going all over the world or America to give lectures, and he has his driver that is driving with him, and the driver always go with him and sits and hear all the sessions, and one evening the lecturer was very tired. And there was a session of question and answers. And he said to the driver, "You go on stage and you'll answer them. You'll be me, you know, everything that I say." And so the driver goes on stage and he's asked a question and he has no idea what the answer is. So he said, "Listen, this question is so banal, it's so simple, even my driver can answer it." He gives it to the driver. So I'm the driver here. What was the question? How do you deal with unwholesome states in daily life? not in a retreat situation. That's the question?
He forgot.
How mindfulness influence the daily life and the unwholesome.
Okay. How mindfulness influence daily life with when we meet unwholesome state in daily life, not in a retreat situation. Yeah.
Unwholesome
is not conducive to peace of mind and to liberation. Filters that really block your possibility to see clearly, and states of mind which are usually, in the classical term, those who are coming from mainly greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay, so things like anger, envy, desire, things like this. The principle is the same. It's just to be able to recognize those unwholesome mental states as quick as possible to their arising, to their appearance, and this depends on the level of mindfulness that one has, and the level of mindfulness is depending on how much practice we put in daily life. So my experience is that the more regularly I practice in daily life, in a busy daily life, sit regularly, try to sit 45 minutes a day, if possible. So the more I sit, the more I'm mindful when something unwholesome arises. And here you see the connection between daily sitting and level of awareness and level of mindfulness that you have. So first try to devote some time in your daily life to formal sitting. It will not be as silent as here, most probably. You will not have the same focus, the same clarity, but still you habituate the mind to come back to mindfulness. And the fruit of the meditation is not in the meditation, it's in life. So that's one way to look at it. Another thing is, what do you do when the state of mind arises? And of course you cannot say to the world, to your boss who is shouting at you, let me experience anger and let me just be with it. I don't think it would be much appreciated. So we learn here a new habit, mental habit, which is always wholesome, is to suspend the automatic reaction. And the automatic reaction, which is not, you're not mindful of, is very harmful. So it's a habit that becomes very useful. Just, okay, I see anger arise, but I breathe one or two or three breath, and then you see what's the best thing to do in the situation. And enough two or three breaths, or one deep mindful breath, to have a better choice of how to respond, and not just to throw away the anger back. And then, whenever it's possible, if you were really angry, for instance, the anger will, to a certain degree, will show up itself later on when you'll have some time to relax and be with it, when you go to bed, when you go to meditate, when you go to eat. And then you can experience it and do what you learned that is best here. Be with it, see what's there, what's the part of you that was hurt, how do you make space to it, and maybe you will not have to do anything else. So, does it answer? That was the driver's response to your master.
So I think Jonathan gave quite an inclusive answer. The only thing I would say is not maybe directly to what you've asked about how to deal with difficult. No, you haven't asked specifically. In general.
It wasn't my question.
It wasn't your question.
No,
well, okay.
I was curious to know. It's a question about your experience, not about the theory. Your personal experience.
Okay.
Because you have a lot of experience.
So Jonathan says just now that it was his personal experience. I mean, he's not talking theory, and none of us here just does. So that was, yeah. For me, I have these little tricks I use that I made up. I actually made up a sticker. And I still got a few. If somebody's interested, and it's, some of you have it. It's called Seven Breaths. Okay, it's a pink, purple one with. It's written on it Seven Breaths, and you can just put it anywhere. You know, I put it on the wheel, for instance, and just before I start the car, I just wait. And I count seven natural breaths, which is around, because people calculated, 14 to 25 seconds before food. Yeah, before I take food, I just stop. And actually before any automatic movement, reaction, yeah, it's quite a good and nice fun way to sort of stop and help the automatic respond to be a different one. And I find it quite valuable, and also in my experience, and also people that are practicing that. And I join Jonathan on the daily sitting. It's precious, and actually it's the thing that keeps the practice going, even though it's like nothing is happening or things happening that we do not like, do it anyway. There are many other things, like in relationship, in my relationship. I try as much as I can remember, even in the heat of things, to look at the other person, my partner or a friend, with a kind eye, to look at each other with kind eyes. It's a part of a sutra that I really, really love. The Buddha is asking some monks how they get along so well, and this is part of their answer. We look at each other, they say, with kind eyes. And of course, all the other things that we are doing here. I mean, mindfulness to the body. We don't actually have to stop in order to do that. When it becomes a skill, it just happens sort of automatically. You just know. It's much more immediate, and it's like you don't have to think about it. It's just something that is happening, right, along with other stuff that is happening. I don't know if it answers some of your questions. Radhaji, if you have anything else to
say. It's an interesting question. I'm thinking, how am I mindful in daily life? When am I mindful in daily life? Am I mindful? And Christopher and I always joke together when we're on retreats, that very often neither of us are particularly mindful or even really known for our great mindfulness. Once, for example, Christopher lost his shoes and we spent an hour looking. There were 130 people on the retreat and we looked at all the different pairs of shoes. And then finally, he suddenly remembered we were looking for the wrong shoes. On another retreat, we had locks on the door that if you didn't take the key with you, you were locked out. Like the lock automatically locked the minute the door was shut. So, of course, you have to get locked out first. Christopher, actually. Guess who gets locked out second? Radha. So it was quite a joke that the teachers of mindfulness were locked out of their rooms. And of course, Radha, being a little more practical than Christopher, managed to open the window, climb through and unlock the door. Rather than wake up the caretakers in the middle of the night. So, to be mindful, actually, no, now the serious part. What I find I am quite mindful of is the arising of thought. And this cycle of contact, feeling, desire, craving, and becoming, as it occurs, is something that I've learned to be very mindful of. And so I actually see the movement of my mind. No one is mindful all the time. The signal that maybe I need to stop and sit or check out what's going on for me would be if there's some kind of feeling that starts to arise in the body. Like, oh, I wonder what's happening for my son, for example, in Guatemala. So there's that little signal in the body, and that means, okay, I have to see into the constructions of thought and then perhaps do something quite practical, like send a text to my daughter and find out what's happening. So we can be mindful of this process of dependent arising, it's called. So we see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think. And if we can be utterly mindful, right then, the whole cycle of dependent arising doesn't actually need to unfold. So if we are mindful at the contact point, so in other words, just seeing, just hearing, just smelling, just tasting, just touching, the whole drama of negativity, of greed, of confusion doesn't unfold. If we don't catch it there, the next step is to be steady with the feeling world. If we can be really equanimous, to have equanimity with the pleasant and unpleasant feeling, then again, we can step out of the mental formations, the formations of self, the formations of mind. It won't be that we never have any thoughts, of course, or that the mind never constructs anything. But it will be that the eye doesn't cling to the constructions, to the thoughts. The eye can rest quite easily in a thought, unproblematically. So that's my mindfulness practice. I tend also to use a lot of inquiry as a very natural kind of way of looking at the world and looking at my life. And that's a really useful thing, I find, to liberate the mind from the being stuck in patterns of desire, being stuck in patterns of negativity, to be stuck in patterns of confusion. For example, with desire, or with negativity rather, the inquiry question that's really useful is, what is the unfulfilled desire?
So yes, there's a lot of negativity landing on other people, the retreat, food, somebody, a memory from the past, yourself even. What is my unfulfilled desire is a really useful question to ask. Enough. Oh.
Is repeating the mantra is meditating? Meditation? Can I call it meditation? I'm repeating some kind of word or...
You want to answer?
So the question was, is repeating a mantra is a meditation, if you're repeating some kind of word? Yes, of course. Many, many, many things are meditation, but it's different from what we are learning here. I think we spoke about it the first day. It's called, obviously you know the name, Vipassana. I think we went a little bit into it, which means it's a word in Pali, seeing clearly, seeing into. Maybe behind the curtains. And in order to do that, we are learning and practicing whatever we were doing here. So actually I'm a little bit, I don't really want to go into comparison. Like, I think there's many good things and they don't have to be in comparison to other things. But it's really beneficial, it's really helpful to learn something and sort of walk with it a while to see if it's a good thing for you, does it resonate with your heart, with your life. Yeah.
Another question.
I want to ask about, in continuance to what you said, Jonathan, about the daily practice. I want to ask all of you, you said also about, like, this morning about the policeman and the thief. And so there are periods in my life when I'm very enthusiastic about going to do this formal everyday meditation, and there are periods that really not. And sometimes when I most need it, I don't want to do it, and I don't want to actually make myself do it. And what do you say about
that? Should I repeat the question?
Mm-hmm.
What the question is, what to do in daily life? I lost it.
How to have this habit of formal meditation and not force it on myself.
Right, right. How to have a wholesome habit of meditation without forcing oneself into it.
Hmm.
And for me it's a simple question: why do I do what I do? And the habit, I think I said it earlier this morning, the habit is that something that at a certain moment we have decided that it is important, very automatically tend to become a must. I need to and I have to. And we forgot that we wanted it. And for me, it's a so helpful and healthy reminder to ask myself, why do I do it? Why do I sit? Definitely, wherever I look, I don't have to sit. I don't see any have and need to sit. I see love for liberation, life for freedom, inner and outer. So when I forget it, it's become a struggle. When it becomes a struggle, I ask myself, why do I do it? Then I remember, I love to meditate. It's so simple. When I hate to do things that I have to. I revolt. I really fight against it. I don't kill anybody, but I don't. There is no enthusiasm in have to and must. So when I see it, and that's the habit of the mind creates it, forms those inner commandments, that's the policeman, and it's a good reminder to ask ourselves, why do we sit here? The Buddha didn't tell us we have to sit. Radha didn't tell you you must sit. We wanted to come and to practice. We want to get clarity and freedom from struggles, unnecessarily conflicts. So it's a good reminder to ask yourself why you do anything, anything, anything. Why do I clean the living room after the kids go to sleep? If I don't ask myself this question, oh Jesus, it's so messy here, and I hate arranging things. And when I think I have to, I suffer. I get angry. And then I remind myself, why do I clean it? And the answer is very simple. I love to be in a clean place. I love, not clean, but how do you say, lesader, arranged, tidy, whatever. So I don't like, it's not easy for me to sit in a place where everything is messy around, you know. So I clean it because I love to be, and the same action with a completely different attitude.
It can also be rather helpful to expand one's notion of what meditation is, and not limit meditation to a particular form, which is sitting cross-legged on the cushion. Then the whole of life can become a meditation. And then there's an extraordinary richness of the simplicity of just meeting this life, meeting the ever-changing nature of it. And when we do that, we're touched by truth, and the truth frees us.
I think you got your answers.
I guess, yeah.
Okay.
Yes, someone from the back.
Yes. This one.
My question is, let's talk practice more about spiritual teachers.
Spiritual teachers.
The question is less about the practice and more about spiritual teachers. Did you hear the rest of the question? That if the teacher is not a fully realized human being, how can my practice develop?
Human being, I don't know about the human being.
Oh, okay.
Fully realized spiritual being?
Yes. Okay.
Oh.
You want to? Hebrew.
Okay. אז השאלה, את רוצה להגיד אותה בעברית?
So when we practice, doubt can land in many different areas. And one of the areas where doubt lands is upon the teacher. So doubt can land on the fact that there is awakening in the first place, so on the Buddha. Doubt can land on some of the teachings. There might be some that we don't agree with. Doubt can land on people in the Sangha, doubt can land on the teacher, and doubt can land on oneself. So these are the five different areas. Very interestingly enough, the Buddha addressed this question. And he said, put your trust in the Dharma itself. So if the teacher is not fully awakened, never mind. Put your trust in the Dharma and continue to practice. If the teacher says some things that are incredibly useful for you, then take that and utilize it. If the teacher says things that you don't really know about or you think, no, I'm not sure about that, then you can put that aside and reflect on it later. In the world of the Dharma, no one is asking you ever to believe a teacher, but rather to find out for yourself. And so the practice is one of coming back over and over to the Dharma, rather than making the focus the personality of the teacher, or the teacher's shortcomings, or the critical mind, of course, can always find fault with somebody. And as a teacher of the Dharma, praise and blame will land right here. Sometimes people are incredibly appreciative, as many people here have been. Sometimes, though, there's something about the way I speak, even. One person complained about the sound of my voice, that the sound of my voice was too lilting and nice. And I couldn't possibly be that nice, so I was a total and utter fraud in his eyes. So you see, there are transferences that land on the teacher. And of course, at my age, I get all those mother transference. When someone is younger, they get perhaps sister and lover transferences. For men, you get the lot. You get lover, father, brother transferences, whether you like it or not. So for us, there's an issue also of being really steady. And so we would ask of you that when doubt arises, that you look and explore and see into it and see if there's any movement of mind that's coming perhaps from your past that's keeping the doubt alive. And for us as teachers, it's our role to be as steady as possible with everything that comes towards us and speak with the greatest of good intention to impart the Dharma. And for myself, if I make an error, then I humbly apologize in advance.
Next.
I have a why question. Why is it like that? Why is it that after all these millions of years of evolution, also spiritual evolution, our mind is constructed with as the way it is, and we saw and we will see many problems with it. It's also brilliant on many other aspects, but the thing that our intuition is that there is a constructed self, that there is individual, that there is separation. And I'm not sure it's something that all cultures in the world, you mentioned the Aborigines, maybe they perceive the world in a different way, I don't know. But why is it like that? Wasn't it, shouldn't we expect after all these billions of years of evolution that it would be something better? If there is something better. Did I make myself
clear? Do you want to repeat the question?
Repeat the question, yeah.
I can tell you one more thing. A few years ago I went to a period of depression, and in period of time in this time, it was so hard that I asked myself, why? Why is it like that? What's the benefit of it?
Mm. Mm. So it's a why question. Why are we made up the way we are? Why do we forget the possibility? Why
do we believe that there is a constructed self?
Yes,
why is
mostly.
It that there is an individual, that there is me, I, and so forth?
Mm-hmm.
If it brings us so many suffering through our lives, why is it like that?
Yes. So, did you hear it all? Okay. There is a beautiful saying, really funny in English. I have no idea where it came from, but I heard Joseph Goldstein once say it. Some folks say life is strange. What I'd like to know is in compared to what? And the mind just start roaming all over the place. It's the same story. This is what it is, and we feel, hang on, there's something wrong with that. Why is it like that? And we start to come up with theories, and all the answers for the why land in the theory world. You can find the answers in many different religions, for instance, or cultures, for instance. And the Buddha actually never liked and never did go into these questions. Not because he didn't have the answer, maybe he did, I have no idea, I wasn't there. But he said very simply, it is not what will free you. And we can see the mind comes up with a lot of explanations, and all of us, me included, likes to play with the ideas and try to look into why is it like that and understand, and the understanding sometimes gives a good feeling because, oh, maybe we did come up with some kind of truth. In the basement of it, we can ask, why are we asking this question? What is the motive, really? What is driving this car of the question, why? That's one aspect. The other one, I would say, that it's quite cool to ask the way you did, like what you add, the last bit, you said you were suffering from depression and you ask, why is this suffering? And sometimes the intensity of suffering and the intensity of the inquiry can actually lead to a very interesting answers. Not necessarily the kind you were sure you were going to get. But just in the mere fact of questioning, it's like in homeopathic doses, right? You get some and then something is happening in the psyche. You know? We don't buy into something anymore. It's something is interesting. What is it? What's going on? And it becomes more of a what than a why question.
So sometimes I agree with Leela. Mm. Not sometimes I agree with Leela. I often agree with Leela. But about this question, why is sometimes a wrong question, shall we say? Why doesn't give us any answer that reduces suffering? Why does someone I love die? There's no answer. The direction in the Buddha Dharma is rather to look at how things arise, the causes and conditions that contribute to the suffering, and the how of that, or to ask what. What is this? What is this depression?
When you have good drivers, you don't have to replace them.
That's funny.
Oh, okay. So the question is, what was my path? How did I become a Dharma teacher? And what did I need to let go of in order to become a Dharma teacher? Okay. As a young child, I had some rather profound experiences that I couldn't explain. They came quite spontaneously. And looking back now, I can see that they were experiences of oneness, or something like that. Experiences that were not the normal kind of reality. And then as I confessed the other night as a young student, I addled my brain with some LSD and had some experiences that were also not, which also showed me that there was a reality other than the conventional world. So I decided that rather than continue taking more drugs for certain experiences, I needed to find out what life was all about. So I caught a plane to Calcutta, walked out of the airport and hopped on a local bus into town. And there began my 1.5 year journey in India. In a few days, I was sitting in Bodh Gaya with Manindraji, who is Joseph Goldstein's teacher and was a wonderful, sweet, lovely, gorgeous man. And I want to just share a little bit because it relates to what I had to let go of. I was really young and naive. And I thought that when I arrived in India, the teacher would say, "Oh, you've come. I've been waiting for you." And what did he say? He looked at me and he said, "Are you traveling alone?" In absolute horror and shock. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Where are you staying?" I said, "I'm staying at the tourist bungalow." And he said, "How much are you paying?" And I told him, and he said, "Too much, too much. You must move to here, tell them I sent you, and don't pay more." Then he said, "Do you have a mosquito net?" And I said, "No." And he said, "You can't meditate without a mosquito net. Go to the tailor. Only pay this much. Tell him I sent you." So you can imagine what was happening to me. All my constructions about the one who was on the spiritual journey were falling into a pile. All my constructions about what the guru or the meditation teacher might be or look like and say to me were also falling apart. So that was my first introduction to meditation. And sometime later, after being in India for a number of months, I met Christopher Titmus, who was then a Buddhist monk. And I'm detouring a little bit, but I came to meet him because out of the blue, after being on a bus all night in India, those of you who have been in India on a bus all night, can imagine what it's like. You're sitting there at the bus station within Pathankot in India, which is kind of affectionately known as the armpit of India. Not a great place to be. And a man I'd never seen in my life before ran up to me and said, "Where are you going?" And an American man. And I said, "I'm going to McLeod Ganj," which was where the Dalai Lama was. And he said, "Stop, stop, you are going the wrong way. You have to go and meet this teacher." This was Christopher. "You have to go and meet," and he said, "Lom Pi." That in English sounds a bit rude. Like a long pi. And I thought, who is this person? So I didn't go immediately. But a few days later, I actually decided to go. And of course, I went expecting Yogananda, or some Indian guru. And again, here was this very sort of thin Englishman. He was a Buddhist monk.
The first time I heard him speak, I knew I'd found my teacher, because I understood everything he said. And I wanted to shout and jump and leap and scream from the back of the room. But I didn't. I was really shy. I just sat there. So I did 6 months of retreat with Christopher. And during that time, I had some profound and deep experiences. I won't go into those here because it's not exactly helpful for people to hear. But much of that involved the deconstruction, or the seeing into the formations of self. I spent 4 hours laughing, rolling on the floor one day, because I could not believe that I had never seen the movement of my mind before. I thought I was a woman on a spiritual journey, and I was being very holy, and then I suddenly realized the stupidity of that, really. I couldn't believe that I'd spent my life thinking I was my feelings and I was my thoughts. And I laughed and laughed and laughed and wept and wept and wept. I just couldn't stop. So that was my first kind of beginning of seeing into the nature of existence. And it went on from there. And I will say that some people have awakenings that are sudden, and some people have insights that are dramatic, after which the whole world is never the same. It's never the same, and in a sense, ever the same. My most profound transformational experience came after about 5 months of meditation practice. So this is great encouragement for you to practice, to do long, long retreat. And insights actually don't ever stop coming. It's not that you have some awakening experience and then you stop learning and you're a big know-it-all and that's the end of that. Not like that. The practice continues. The teaching now is the practice for me. And the insights still come. The insights still come. And what did I have to let go of? Everything. Everything. Enough?
No.
Yes.
It's a little bit, you didn't ask, how do you become a teacher?
Ah, yes, thank you. How did I become a Dharma teacher? I had lots of deep insights on this retreat. I was, prior to that, an incredibly quiet and shy person. I didn't actually even speak to Christopher for 10 years about what had happened. When I told him, I said, but I had these experiences, but I can't teach. I can't teach. Can't sit up the front and give a Dharma talk. So he very sweetly said, Radha, you don't have to. You don't have to. And then, of course, some years later, he asked me to come and teach with him in India. And at that time, I said yes. So here I am. Been teaching in India for the last 10 years, but it took me, I guess, 28 years from my initial experiences to get to the point where I gave a Dharma talk. My first Dharma talk was called The Deathless. the other person who, I guess, acknowledged me, or whatever you want to say, or there's several others actually, but was Christopher's teacher, Ajahn Buddhadasa. I went to speak with him, and he asked me what my understanding was. And so, very naively, I just stood there and told him what my understanding was. And he was incredibly acknowledging and invited me to stay in the monastery at Wat Suan Mok in southern Thailand for as long as I wanted. So that's how I came to be a teacher.
Yes.
During this week, kind of noticed that I have many thoughts of the future. I've seen myself repeatedly thinking about the future. Most of the time, thinking worried thoughts. I kind of try to do what you taught here, to look at the thoughts and to be with them. But I kind of ask myself two things. One is any tendency of the mind to look ahead with a worried look, and what to do. And second question, when I look at the future and I see a worried thought and I'm still worried, what to do?
The question was clear, that was heard? Yeah, okay. So, what to do with in normal daily life situation with thoughts of worry, feelings of worry? Why should you do anything?
I think it kind of paints the way I look at the future. It kind of makes me kind of tell myself this is all what you see in the future, this is what will be in the future.
That's the answer. You just see it as painting the reality. That's it. It's a layer between the observing and reality. So you just see it. Don't need much to do. That's it. You see it, you know it, you know it's worry. And you ask yourself, where is the problem? There is worry. Where is the problem? Worry, if you know it as worry, it's okay. It's real as worry. It just is worry. It's real, but not more than that.
But after saying myself this, I still the formation of the future hasn't changed. Like I still see.
Yeah. So, but you know that the future is a construct. Nobody can see the future, right? Future is real as a construct, right? You cannot perceive the future except with thoughts, right? You don't. Future, there is no future. It's always, we experience everything in the present moment, right? It's always a present moment. What we think is a projection, right? So we just see it as a projection. There's no problem. Projections, if the fantasy about the future is pleasant, so we began to desire it, right? To crave for it. If the fantasy about the future is unpleasant, we start to worry about it. That's it. That's the way the mind works. So we see it, and that's worry. Hey, 2 days I didn't feel the worry. Welcome. Take a seat. Be with me. It's okay. You just see it. You can also inquire, really? Is it really so? Is it really so terrible as the worry tells me? You make friends with it, you entertain it, and you see what's coming next. I think the biggest problem with worry is that we we fear of it. We believe that the worry is wrong. We believe that worry shouldn't be here. In order for me to, I should get rid of worry. So we start to fight with it, and we don't much succeed. And then we start to blame ourselves. I'm so hopeless, I don't succeed after so many retreats and meditation, I still worry. So it becomes, we create a problem out of worry, where worry is just there. You make a space to it, no problem, it's a filter. That's not really beautiful filter, but it's there. Okay, and the emotional part that comes with it, the unpleasant sensation, things get constricted,
contracted.
Worry is not really pleasant sensation, it's more, so you make space to this, it's okay. That was a dry present. Now the real answer.
I think we can take another question. Yes?
Okay, I have another personal question. Since you started and told us about your spiritual growth path, I have to ask you, because for me, I always thought that in order to be fully realize yourself, I don't know if I'm using the term correctly, but to fully realize yourself spiritually, you have to give up the not spiritual world. I mean, in order to go to a six month retreat, you have to stop your. How can you do this and also have a profession, have a family, four children? It's a lot of. How can you do it all?
So the question is, how can we do it all without giving up our daily life? So how can we live a liberated life or seek awakening and still live in the world? We could live for many years in a cave and it be a total waste of time. There's one woman who did this for 7 years, and afterwards she said exactly that. I have wasted my time. It's a tragedy. So what we're being asked to give up is our clinging to the world. Not being in it, not living with it. But rather, we're being asked to change our relationship to the world. We're being asked to free the mind. And then we discover that the world, too, is empty. The world is empty of inherent existence. And when we discover this, it doesn't mean that there's some kind of miserable, depressive kind of emptiness that haunts us. It's not that kind of emptiness. But when we discover that, there's a wonderful relationship with the whole of life. There's an engagement. And then we're free to be in the cave, or we're free to have a family. Didn't I feel I have to choose?
You have to choose from between spirituality and daily life.
Okay.
You have this dilemma.
Didn't I ever have a dilemma between spirituality and daily life?
You have to give up something in order to be in your path.
Didn't I have to give up something in order to be on the path? I said before, I had to give up everything.
daily life and spirituality are not two. They're not separate from one another. Then the whole of life is a meditation. The heart mind has the capacity to embrace all things. The messy house and the life of a renunciate as well.
You want to add?
Let's have another question.
To ask this Advaita question, who wants to know?
to choose.
So it's a question about choosing and how to choose, and like you used to make lists, and it's I think I said it in the, we have these meetings after you all guys go to sleep. Long meetings, we talk about the Dharma, and we talk about many things with the staff, kitchen, and managers. And I think it came up in one of the meetings. It's quite a tricky one, because somehow in this area we really believe the choice is something that we take. But if you take a good look, honest look at your life, you and every person here, and think back about the choices in your life, like the big ones, getting pregnant, one, going to university to study this, or deciding to quit, or going abroad, or getting married, or getting a divorce, or whatever, like the big ones, if you buying a house. Huh? How did it come to be? Really, how did it come to be? There is a very interesting survey, Michkar, that was done about choices. And apparently they put some electrodes in the brains of people. I don't know how they do it, but they found out that the choice actually happens half a second before the person feels she or he made the choice. So that's quite amazing, because half a second is a long time. Something is happening, and then we are quick, or not that quick, half a second quick, maybe according to this survey, to catch and claim ownership. And it could have been a funny thing if it wouldn't have caused many of us so much suffering, because we feel so pressured to come to the right choice, as if our lives depend on it. And in the base of it, there is a fear. And we want the pleasant, and we don't want the unpleasant, and the pot is stirring. When we do take this good look on how things are really happening, try it. I don't want to, you know, give you the answers, but just see for yourself in the area of thoughts, for instance, how thoughts arise. Do you invite them to come? Do you choose and control them? Or is it entirely a different story here of a process rather than a fixed thing in time and space? So I would suggest to bring some lightness into this and a lot of investigation. Personally, for me, it used to be, and I told the staff, and it used to be one of my pet subjects. I really, really loved these questions of choices and decision making and how these things are happening. But be prepared to some surprises.
Yes.
I believe that there are several things which can be very beneficial, let's say in the business world or generally in the world today, the modern world. And they are not what they may call Dharma compatible. My question is, would you agree that if someone wants to become today, wants to become a prime minister or a CEO of a big company, that his chances are not that good? He's a real Dharma practitioner, serious Dharma practitioner.
Did you hear the question? What's the question? That chances are low because he's a Dharma practitioner? Who knows?
I'm talking mainly about, from my experience, and I'm talking about clinging to results.
Right. Why would you want to become a prime minister? Okay. Yeah, some people love suffering, have a special joy in it, so why not, if they want it. Honestly, I have no idea. I think that you see it rightly, clinging to results is very painful. That's source of the pain is the clinging to results. But you can be a very, beneficial manager or any other activity that you feel precious to do, and you don't have to cling to results. You have to cling to, not to cling, of course, but you have to be very attentive to the motivations with which you want to do things, and then be very mindful to the actions followed by those motivations, and then to monitor results, but not cling to results. Results are never in our control. Never. Ask Obama about it. The most powerful person in the world, apparently. Results are far away from his satisfaction, and he's really a very strong man. He has the strongest army around, the strongest economy yet. Results are very far away from what he expects. You do your best in being attentive to motivation, the why you do things, and then the actions that follow.
Yes.
This has come to a time when after you practice a lot of times that you stop suffering, like you stop feeling pain, you stop. You just can concentrate on the breath and say, okay, and enjoy it.
Okay. Does it come after lots of practice
that you stop feeling pain and you stop suffering and you can just enjoy it. I take it you mean meditation. Discomfort and suffering, or dukkha, are not the same. We can have awareness of our discomfort, and that's all it is. And we very often have little tolerance for discomfort. I'm always reminded of this when I travel on a train in India. And the last time I was traveling on a train in India, in the space where six people were meant to sit, there I was with 18 men, me and 18 Indian men, all trying to fit in this small space. Eventually, I did manage to lie down on my bed with people very close to me, someone sitting on the end of my bed all night. And then I looked across the kind of aisle to the three tiers, and there was a man sitting, and he was hunched like this. Honestly, he was just between two Indian beds, and he was bent over, and he was there all night. He didn't complain. And then I thought, okay, I can put up with my aches and pains in meditation. But yes, it does become much easier to sit after a while. We'll just take a few more questions. Yes. Yes.
For you, you spoke about this several times in the retreat.
Yes.
And I want to know if Buddhism claims truth, or is the truth the dukkha and the release from it? You don't have to claim anything absolute outside, like monotheistic religions. And when you speak about truth, do you only mean the way that we look at reality, or do we actually see something specifically, like God, or logic, reason?
Okay, so the question is about absolute truth. If I might change the question slightly from absolute truth to ultimate truth, because absolute tends to be a bit definitive.
Or objective.
Objective.
Objective. Ah, okay. I wouldn't say objective. So in the world of the Dharma teachings point to the truth of things. The four noble truths are the truths of the noble ones. And of course those truths are that in this life there's suffering, there's causes and conditions that lead to the suffering, there's liberation from suffering, and the path to liberation. We can directly experience the touch of truth. We know it's truth when it liberates and frees us. We can't claim truth. We can't, through any effort of the mind, go to truth. Rather, we have to just await it. And there's plenty to go around. The Buddha said, truth is that which has an undeceptive nature, does not deceive. Nagarjuna, the philosopher that we heard about in the Dharma talk, has written a wonderful kind of analysis of the Buddha Dharma and the teachings of ultimate and conventional truth.
In conventional truth, we would say we are born, we live, we grow old, we die. Speaking in the language of the ultimate, we would say we are unborn. There is the deathless. So these are the two different languages that are associated with ultimate truth and conventional truth. However, when truth is really seen, the understanding of that is not two. In the Sutta Nipata, it says, truth is one without a second. So in other words, truth has no opposite when it's seen and known for yourself. The Buddha teaches the middle path between eternalism and annihilationism. The middle path is that which is dependently arisen. Dependent arising and emptiness are the same thing. We see that things are dependently arisen when we really look and see the causes and conditions and the unfolding nature of life. When we can just unhook the self from this process of contact, feeling, desire, clinging, and becoming, when we just step out of the way and we see the unfolding pattern, we notice that life unfolds incredibly freely all by itself. And when we see that, there's no division anywhere. No division anywhere. And then it's our suffering that's unborn. The self that becomes over and over again is the cause of great trouble in this life. So it needs to be seen. The Buddha used more than 100 different words to describe liberation and freedom. Things like nibbana, which means literally to cool off. The unborn, the undying, the deathless. He called it the marvelous. In other words, like the miracle. And he said what is marvelous is that we can simply see that which arises, stays, and passes. And when we're really with the experience and see it, that's the marvelous. That's the liberation. So the truth is to be directly known and experienced. And touched for yourself. And it's not that you haven't had moments of truth and freedom and liberation. We all have lots of them. So the Dharma doesn't posit some kind of absolute reality or ultimate reality that's far away. So we can discover it, we can see it, we can see into life right now. And then truth and just us sitting here tonight are not separate. This is the truth of things. This is how things have come to be. That's all.
Finished?
I'm just noticing that it's actually 9:00. So I know there's more questions, but we might actually leave it there. Let's just sit for a minute. thank you, each of you, for your presence, for listening, and thank you to those of you who asked questions. And to you, Leela. And to you for just sitting beside me here. And for your wisdom. It's just a great joy to teach with you. We've had a great time. Not over yet. There's more to come. So it's 9:05. You've been sitting here for a long time. So we could end with a walking meditation. You could end by looking at the stars and awaiting the truth. So thank you. Enjoy the walking meditation. Good night. See you in the morning.